Chapter 11. It was a while before I could speak. I was so tightly wound that one wrong word from anyone, one perfectly innocent gesture, might have set me off. The emotions coursing through me were so strong, I felt as if I were vibrating like a tuning fork. I felt as if I had been taken up, then down, then brought back up, and then slammed down again, and I didn't even know what was real anymore. What's more, I wasn't even certain that I cared. All I knew was that I felt angry. More than angry. Furious. Like a heat-seeking missile looking for a target to destroy.
Did you know?
I finally asked Breck when I thought I could control myself well enough to handle a normal conversation. He had understood. He had given me the time I needed, and now he answered cautiously, gauging my reactions to see just how close to the edge I really was.
That it was a hallucinact program,
he said.
Nine. Of course not.
You handled it much better than I did, I said.
I would not say so.
I panicked. I lost my nerve.
Though I have panicked, had not that particular circuit been bypassed in my genetic programming,
Breck said.
I merely reacted in the only way I could react. I want to survive as much as you do. The fact that I do not have the ability to feel afraid does not make me more courageous than you are.
Funny, I said. You seem fascinated by the emotion of fear because you can't experience it. Right about now, I'd give a lot to be wired the way you are. I don't seem to be handling this very well. I wanted to kill that bastard Coles. Still do. But even if I got my hands around his throat, how do I know he'd really die? It all seems so goddamned real. How do I know this is real right now? I mean, what if this is all the same hallucinact? What if we're still lying back there in the game center, only thinking we'd come out of it? Maybe we never came out of it at all. Maybe none of this has happened. Maybe it's all been programmed a hallucination right from the very start. How the hell does anybody tell?
I cautioned you before,
Breck said.
When all this started, I warned you not to think about it. Forget about hallucinacs. Treat everything as if it were absolutely real. Chances are it is. If it is not, and you have approached it with the other hand, if you begin to doubt the reality of your experience, you will stop trusting your senses, or at least you will develop the tendency to question your perceptions during moments of stress. That could prove fatal, and that way also lies insanity.
You mean you never wonder about it?
Nine,
said Breck.
I have learned to force it from my mind. It is not very difficult to do. It is far easier to trust in the evidence of your senses than to question what they tell you. Suppose I had succumbed to doubt while that illusory skimmer was spiraling down in a crash dive. Suppose it had not been a hallucinact. But then, I might have found something to cling on in the face of such a desperate situation. I might have attempted to convince myself that it was all an illusion, because what my senses were telling me was real seemed so helpless. And since it had seemed helpless, I might have simply given up and hoped that I would wake from it in one piece. But if it had been real, we would have been dead. Instead, I treated it as real. It never occurred to me to question its reality, and so I continued fighting to pull out of that dive right to the very end. Because I might have managed it, you see.
Yes, I see. No false hopes that way.
Precisely.
I'm surprised it doesn't drive the players crazy.
It often does,
Breck said.
A high percentage of the players in high-risk scenarios become insane. For what should be obvious reasons, the company does not release those figures. That would not make for very good publicity.
It seemed utterly ridiculous. Here we were, part of only a handful of people who knew that humanity had been infiltrated by alien life forms, and we were talking about what might or might not be favorable publicity for Psychodrome. I was filled with a sense of deja vu again. We were flying high above the city in a skimmer piloted by one of Cole's men, the very same man who had piloted the skimmer in the Hallucinact. The intricacies of cybernetic reality programming in the hands of a man like Cole's was a frightening thought. Nothing had been wasted. The Hallucinact had been designed to maximize the flow of data so that we could immediately respond to the situation without delay when we woke from it. Cole's was not concerned about the recommended rest interval following a programming. The data feed from the alien's biochip had been incorporated into the illusion, and it had been real, even if our experience was not. We hadn't lost much time. And if we had proved to be draconians in human form, well, then Coles would have accomplished a large part of his objective by inducing us to shape change while still under his control. A complicated thinker, Mr. Coles.
Well, at least there's one good thing about all this,
I said.
So long as they're not broadcasting our experiences, Sakaar's assassins don't know where I am.
Breck glanced at me sharply.
Would you believe I had forgotten all about that?
Things have been a little hectic lately,
I said.
I would not advise relaxing yet, said Breck. In some ways, we are even more vulnerable now than we were before. We still have the Ambermorph to deal with. And just because our experience is not being broadcast does not mean we are safe from your Egyptian friend. It has been announced that we have returned from the Fire Islands. Anyone watching for us at Game Headquarters will know we are back. We must be careful.
We?
I said.
It's me they want, Rudy. This isn't your fight.
I'm commendable sentiment, O'Toole, but we are in this thing together. Besides, I have a bone or two of my own to pick with your Mr. Sakaar. Several of my fellow hybrids were killed back at Draconis Base by his assassins. In a sense, that is like losing family. As soon as this is over, I think you and I should take some time off to go to Tokyo and do something about Mr. Sakaar. Something rather drastic.
Sorry to interrupt your private business, gentlemen,
Cole said through the interface.
But there are some somewhat more urgent matters to attend to. We've got another data feed we're going to boot up to you. The signals are starting to come in less frequently. We may be losing the implant. Stand by for an update.
The first image to come in startled me so badly that for a moment, I thought I was having a flashback from the Hallucinact. Suddenly, it seemed as if I were spinning downward in the skimmer once again, plummeting toward the ground. It didn't help that we were sitting in the back of an airborne skimmer as the data feed came in. It took me a moment to realize that what I was experiencing were the perceptions of the shape changer in its bird form as it swooped down for a landing. It was a wild sensation as I suddenly felt myself gliding earthward with great speed, saw the ground rushing up toward me, and, with no awareness of transition whatsoever, it seemed as if I were walking down a street, my eyes roughly level with those of the other pedestrians around me. There had been no awareness of size at all, no difference to speak of between the way it felt to be in bird form and what obviously had to be human form again, walking down the sidewalk. Either it had been one heck of a large bird, or the draconian was able to alter its size effortlessly, with no more awareness of the process than I had of my own hair growing. That did not seem possible. It was a volitional change. There had to be some sort of awareness. What was more, how could it alter its size without affecting its mass? In human form, it seemed to have normal mass for a human. When it had disguised itself as stone, it had not seemed any heavier or lighter than it should have seemed. I hadn't paid any real attention to it then. But Breck and I would surely have noticed if she was significantly lighter or heavier than she should have been. That meant that, as a human, the draconian had approximately the same mass and weight as the human whose shape it had adopted. Yet it had shape-changed into a bird. Unless the bird had been something the size of a California condor, how could the draconian have become smaller without dramatically increasing the density of its mass?
And in that case, how could it have flown? What the Draconian did, apparently as effortlessly as I could blink, seemed to contravene known science. The laws of physics were no different for Draconians than they were for us. Were they? No, that was impossible. But then, what the hell did I know? I wasn't a physicist. Just trying to follow secondary school physics had left me hopelessly confused and feeling like a moron. I had a feeling that the Draconian was about to provide me with an exquisite revenge. Wait till those physicists got a load of this, I thought. There was a blurring, dizzying effect. Then the image changed. Dim light, a cacophony of street sounds, a strange, inexplicable throw focus effect that came in and out, as if someone were literally playing with the focus on a camera. At first, the focus was directly to the front, with areas on the periphery blurring into indistinct shapes and colors. Then the effect was reversed, then reversed again. Then the field widened and narrowed, then widened again.
But do you believe it?
I heard Breck's disembodied voice say, as if from somewhere far off instead of right next to me.
The creature is experimenting, learning to control the biochip.
I suddenly felt cold, then warm, then cold again. It wasn't supposed to be able to do that.
What the hell is it doing?
I asked Breck, hoping to receive some reassurance.
Changing its body temperature?
My voice sounded normal to me, but Breck's reply again seemed somewhat distant.
Your guess is as good as mine,
he said.
I thought you were supposed to be the resident expert on shape changers,
I said.
I suppose I am,
he said.
That does not sound very encouraging, does it?
According to the cybernetic staff here,
Cole said through the interface, cutting into the feed,
the creature is probably, emphasis on the word probably, altering the biochip signals rather than its own body temperature. The visual effect, the blurring focus and so forth, seems to support that theory. The engineers aren't very happy about this development. Apparently, it's not supposed to be able to do that.
That's what I thought, I said. The data feed resumed. Whip pan! The effect was not unlike that of a video technician executing what's known as a wipe, in which the camera appears to pan very swiftly, as if mounted on a speeding vehicle so that there was the visual sensation of blurred movement all in one direction, going from one scene to a completely different one. Ground level, very dim, shadowy, foreboding. Concrete jungle of the lower depths, not unlike Tokyo's junk town, deja vu again, proceeding down a dark alleyway past slithering shapes and prostrate derelicts moaning in piles of refuse, descending down a flight of steps and going through a doorway.
Volume.
Driving beat of electronic frenzy, bodies moving, amplified voices in staccato monotone. The lost children of the urban basement ghetto congregating in nihilistic tribal ritual. Most of them very young, slack-jawed, glitter-eyed, robotic motion dancing, colliding with each other and rebounding aimlessly to the rhythmic tempo of a mechanistic heartbeat. A blasted stage elevated high above the floor, musicians standing in the rubble, wired for sound, fingers plucking strings and dancing over keyboards, hardwired into garish costumes, vocals processed through vocoders surgically implanted into throats. Interface of man and instrument, the child and the city, the ambience of hopelessness and dying dreams. Moving through the crowd, being jostled by the swirling bodies, scanning, smelling, feeling, standing at the bar and drinking, recoiling from the harsh, unpleasant taste, throwing down the glass, it shatters on the bar, no sound, drowned out by the driving music. Bartender sweeps away the shattered glass without a thought. Such an act, not remarkable in such a place, where violence is part of the atmosphere to be partaken of. A hand touching the shoulder softly, lingering, sliding slowly down the upper arm and stopping at the elbow, moving up again and down in a caress. A voice close to the ear. Very close.
Touch me. Touch me now. Right here.
a hand closing on the wrist and moving it toward a breast, barely contained by an open jacket of synthetic skin, almost like human flesh. The feel of it, the flap of the jacket being brushed aside as she moved the hand directly to the breast, now bared. Shining eyes in a hard little face. Feral pretty. Tall crest of golden hair ending in a long tail, cascading from behind the neck and down the right side of the chest. Body slim and youthfully cultish. Moist lips parted, shallow breathing, the feeling of a young heart beating, seeking nothing more complicated than momentary physical fulfillment.
End feed.
The skimmer had landed.
Let's go, you two,
the pilot said.
I want to be airborne and out of here before the screamers in this neighborhood strip this thing for parts.
We're losing it,
said Coles.
The creature's practically got the biochip under its control. Best estimate places it somewhere within half a mile of your current location. We are activating every available biochip implantee within the sector. Be prepared to receive your update feeds at any time. I'm going to boot data up to you as fast as it comes in.
Wait,
Breck said.
What do you mean by available implantees? And how do you expect us to function if we start receiving perpetual transmissions without warning? Do you think you have any idea how disorienting?
I haven't got time to explain everything as I go along,
said Coles.
I'm going to say this only once, so pay attention. You two are going to have to think fast on your feet. These are combat conditions, Breck. I'm having all the company records of former Psychodrome players pulled and sorted, classified by sectors of the city. We're going to be tapping into every available biochip in the vicinity where the creature was last seen. I want to be able to cover every available...
Wait a minute, I said, astonished at what Coles was proposing.
Have you lost your mind? We can't do that. You can't just arbitrarily start tapping into people like that. It's against the law. We're faced with an alien invasion, O'Toole,
said Coles.
If it would safeguard national security and the interests of the human race, I'd break every damn law ever written in this or any country. Okay, over to your right there, that looks like the place where the creature landed. You should be getting close.
I don't think he has any idea what he's doing, I said to Breck. He's talking about the most massive invasion of privacy in human history. The minute he starts tapping into those people, he's going to have every lawyer in the country screaming bloody murder. Can he really do that?
I think he can, said Breck. And I fear he knows exactly what he is doing. Think about it. Are you aware of being monitored during the game scenarios? You know it is happening, of course, but are you actually aware of it happening?
Jesus, I said. He's just going to start accessing people, and they're not even going to know what's happening. It's a paranoid's nightmare.
It makes you wonder, said Breck. There are a great many wealthy, influential individuals who have played the game at one time or another. People with access to all sorts of interesting information.
It was a chilling thought. I realized that something like this had occurred to me before, but I had never followed it through. Maybe because I had been afraid to. I remember thinking when the whole thing started about what Psychodrome might one day do with all the people it's been wiring up. If the government had ever tried to pass a law that every citizen had to be wired with a biochip capable of interfacing with a centralized computer network, there would have been an instant revolution. But make it all a glamorous game with fabulous sums of money at stake, a recreation for the rich and famous, a media event, an entertainment, and the lineup to buy lottery tickets to take a chance on winning the ultimate fascist prize. My Russian archbishops were nodding knowingly somewhere at the back of my subconscious. This was nothing new to them. The method was different, but the results were still the same. My Russian ancestors had lived under the most autocratic, most repressive regime in all of human history. Absolute power resided in one man or woman, the Tsar of the Tsarina. Absolute power backed up by a divine right in a country that had no conception whatsoever of what freedom meant.
Catherine the Great had thought nothing of gifting a departing lover with a palace and 4,000 or so penitents. People had been sold in the marketplace like furniture, entire families regarded as possessions, capable of being bought more cheaply than a horse or hunting dog. Even the nobility were subject to the whims of the autocracy, told where and how to live, whom to marry or divorce, even when to live or die. The Soviet state, which had replaced the monarchy, had not been very different. One czar had been replaced by a council of small-time czars, the Politburo, and things went on much as before. Things like this were not supposed to happen in our country in these modern times. Freedom was a guarantee, taken for granted. Or had we, after all, merely been sold a bill of goods, conned into thinking ourselves superior and more privileged, more liberal and enlightened than our predecessors and all the other nations of the world? A man like Coles was like a pail of cold water thrown into the face of all my notions of democracy and inalienable rights. A man like Coles did not spring out of nowhere. He had been nurtured and developed by a system, a power structure I had never really been aware of until now. My great-grandfather, whom my father had been so fond of quoting to me, had been one of the great iconoclasts and cynics of his time, an unregenerate technophobe who had disdained the rules and had a hatred of what he called the microchip mentality. He despised the buzzword glorification of the techno-state and had lived on the fringes all his life. He did not fear computers, but he was afraid of what could be done with them. He protested against driver's licenses with photographs and social security numbers on them, bank cards with built-in memory, cashless economy, and bureaucratic centralizations. "They've got your number," was an ominous phrase to him, and he had passed on his fringe philosophy to all his sons and daughters. I had always thought of him as a paranoid and harmless old eccentric. Now I saw that he had not been harmless. He had been a dangerous man. The trouble was, there hadn't been enough men like him. We had found the alleyway the creature landed in, the place where it had shape-changed back into human form. As we walked down the darkened corridor between two buildings, several forms detached themselves from the shadows and stood in the center of the alley, blocking our way. I glanced over my shoulder and saw more behind us. Young people.
Cyberpunks.
We were trespassing on their turf, and that made us fair game. With these kids, artifice was art. They went all out to cultivate the image of the Technoman. Spiky hair and multicolored rooster crests, the skin of their shaved heads corrugated with the look of subcutaneous cyberwires, ball-bearing eyes shining in the dark, teeth bared to show glittering steel incisors. It was all cosmetic. In the morning, the corrugated scalps peeled off, the steel tooth caps were removed, the silvered eye cups painstakingly taken off, and the kids went off to work, if they were lucky enough to have jobs, or to while the afternoons away in the laborer pool, which basically meant wasting time standing in line to get their dole. Even if they could afford the extensive process of cyber modification, the sort of external appearance they favored would have left them unemployable. So they settled for the cosmetic look and spending money on vocoders, which could be surgically implanted or worn externally. Not quite as much cachet, turned on or off as the occasion warranted. In this case, an ominous presence called for the vocoders to be on, and we were greeted with a grating electronic overlay of snake voices hissing from the leader's voice box.
"What's worth yet to keep on living?"
"I have no time for you," said Breck. "Get out of the way."
"What's this? Hard man looking for fast times, hard trade? Dump this mother's file."
Breck pulled off his glove and five long, gleaming Nysteel blades sprung out. He held the blades inches away from the cyberpunk's face.
"If you want hard trade, son, I would be happy to oblige."
I pulled out my plasma pistol and snapped off a charge at the feet of the punks behind us. They leaped back from the explosion of blue flame and scattered. The snake-voiced cyberpunk suddenly found himself alone, staring wide-eyed at Breck's blades.
"Don't cut me, man. Please. Please.
Turn that ridiculous thing off.
Anything you say, man. Just don't cut me, all right? Please?
We are looking for a girl, Breck said. Young, very pretty in a hard sort of way. Golden hair, worn in a very long crest. She was wearing a scarlet skin jack and high black boots. Tattoo of one blue teardrop right here,
Breck said, touching the cyberpunk's cheek with his blades. That's a hard time ride, man. She killed people just for juice. You're no Vark, man. What do you want with her?
Never mind what I want with her. Where can I find her?
I don't owe that damn slit nothing, man. She's likely back to her place, picked herself up some new hard meat. Radical looking mods. Heavy hardware.
What the hell is that moron talking about?
Cole said through the interface. Breck ignored him and got directions to the girl's place. The girl picked up someone new, someone these kids don't know, I translated for Coles. The other terms were meant to be complimentary, I suppose, describing cosmetic modifications. Perhaps not so cosmetic in this case. It seems the alien's shape changed into a cyberpunk, the better to blend in down here.
Okay, it checks,
said Coles.
We just received an update from an implantee in Sector 3 on ground level. A former lottery winner who's a compartment manager in a box warren on St. Mark's. Visual readout matches the description of the girl. She was seen entering a building with a young male cyberpunk. Hold it. Let me give you a visual. Got it. Stand by.
Coles was learning quickly. He was using the system as well as a player master and coming up with wrinkles even Mondigo didn't know about. At least, I didn't think he knew. I was no longer sure. I imagined that what Coles had done was activate every biochip in the ground level neighborhood he had designated as Sector 3, then initiate a centralized scanning program to monitor every one of them. He had directed the program to flag a readout containing a visual matching the girl's description, and now he isolated it, enhanced the image of the male she was with, and booted it up to us. It was an image like a still frame, enlarged and enhanced from the original, seen through the eyes of the compartment manager across the street, who has probably had nothing better to do than sit at the window of his box warren cubbyhole and stare outside all day, thinking about the one time he had his shot and blew it. He had walked away from it with nothing but the memory of whatever his psychodrome experience had been and a biochip implanted in his brain, a semi-organic microcomputer that had grown together with his brain matter, always a part of him, always representing his potential. He could buy computer interface time and have himself programmed with knowledge that would gain him a new and better life. But there was, of course, a catch. There always was. First, he had to be able to afford it. If he saved a little every year, perhaps in another 5 or 10 years, he'd have the necessary funds to buy himself an education. But living where he lived was not very conducive to saving money. A lifestyle such as that required anesthetic. I saw his in the form of the bottle his hand held before his face. He had been in the process of lifting the bottle to his mouth when the readout had been frozen. In the background, a girl dressed in a scarlet skin jack and high black boots walked arm in arm with a young male cyberpunk.
Enhance. Zoom in.
I could no longer see the bottle the man was drinking from. The scene across the street was closer, the focus on the couple.
Enhance. Zoom in.
Their upper bodies and their faces now close together, apparently talking to each other.
Enhance. Zoom in.
Now, just their faces.
Enhance. Zoom in.
It was Racine, only a much younger, cyberpunk version of Racine, with a tall black crest of spiky hair crowning a corrugated scalp, exaggerated cheekbones, silvered eyes, snake fangs protruding over the lower lip. It's him, I said, automatically thinking of the draconian as he, when in fact, I had no idea of its gender or even if it had one.
Curious that it should use that face again, said Breck. Almost as if it were expecting. Damn! Cause, if the Ambermorph had learned how to control its biochip and You have directed these computers to activate every known biochip in the sector, then.
Shit,
Cole said.
The son of a bitch knows we're scanning for it. I'm calling in the strike force. Get over there fast. Move!
We started running hard. The place was only a couple of blocks away. Breck was in better shape than I, and he started outdistancing me quickly, even while speaking to Coles.
Coles,
he said.
Try to feed the Draconian Ein Hallucinact program. See if you can disorient it, confuse it long enough for us to get there.
It was all I could do to stay with him for the first 10 or 20 yards while he spoke to Coles. And then he was off, and I couldn't hear him anymore. But I heard Coles replying through the interface.
It's no good. We've already tried it. We can't even access the creature's biochip anymore. It figured out some way to block out incoming signals. We've done all we can do from here.
Breck was outpacing me rapidly, running like a streak towards St. Mark's Place in one of the most ancient and rundown neighborhoods of New York City. He was already a full city block ahead. As I turned into St. Mark's Place, a dimly lit blasted avenue with huge cracks in the long, untended pavement and rubble from wrecked buildings lying everywhere, I saw Breck running full speed into the ruined building where the cyberpunk girl and the draconian had gone. I had to stop for a moment, gasping. I simply couldn't match Breck's high-breed body for speed and strength and stamina. I fought for breath, telling myself that I probably wouldn't be much help to him in any case. And then I saw the girl leaving the building. It didn't hit me for a second. Then I started running, pulling out my plasma pistol as I ran. I dodged among the wreckage of what had once, centuries ago, been a stately neighborhood, handsome building facades on tree-lined streets beneath a pale blue sky. Now it looked like the aftermath of a firebombing, everything cracked and peeling, fallen down and wounded. No blue sky visible above. Not even a polluted brown sky, just the dark weight of the city overhead, pressing down on the sorry excuse for a neighborhood and its even sorrier inhabitants. I followed a scarlet skinjack along sleek legs and high black boots. I was so winded from the run I could barely breathe, yet I forced myself to keep on running, unable to cry out, hoping Coles was scanning me. I was gaining, getting closer. The girl heard my running footsteps coming up behind her, and she turned around. And it was Stone. I froze in the act of pointing the pistol at her.
Arkady, don't. It's me, Stone.
O'Toole, don't kill it. I want that thing alive.
Let me go, Arkady. Please. They'll hurt me.
5 skimmers swooped down low over my head and landed in the street, canopy sliding back, disgorging soldiers armed with plasma weapons. And suddenly, all hell broke loose. Several plasma blasts slammed into the street close behind me, and one passed so low over my head that it set me on fire. Instinctively, I dropped down to the ground and returned the fire, shooting blindly in the direction from which the plasma blast had come. I slapped at my hair and clothing, and I rolled, trying to extinguish the flames. My skin felt scorched from the close passage of the plasma blasts, and I realized I had come within millimeters of being incinerated. I was completely out in the open, no cover anywhere. The best I could do was roll into a huge pothole that only partially concealed my body. As if lying in a trench, I tried to squeeze down into the hole and looked quickly from side to side, trying to find out who was shooting at me, and then I saw them, dodging from doorway to doorway on the opposite end of the street, black-suited ninjas converging on me and firing as they ran. There were at least 5 of them, maybe more. The soldiers had responded to the fire, and they returned it, some dropping to the ground, some deploying in doorways and in crumbling basement stairwells.
Sakara!
I screamed in an agony of frustration.
God damn you! Not now! Not now!
The street became a war zone, and I was caught right in the crossfire. I couldn't move. Plasma blasts were passing so low over my head that I could feel their heat. They slammed into the building walls behind me, and the ancient tenements began to burn. I heard screaming.
I was back in the jungle, slogging through the swamps as auto pulsar fire and plasma rockets landed all around me. I saw insects buzzing in front of my eyes, and I seemed to feel them crawling up on me. I felt them right through the combat armor. I felt the heat, the sweat running down my body. I couldn't breathe, and I began to scream. A long, drawn-out, throat-rending scream of killer fury. My scream was suddenly joined in chorus with another, and I looked up to see a ninja. Black garments wreathed in flames, wailing like a banshee as he dove down at me. I fired. The plasma hit his chest point blank, and he became a fireball. I ducked beneath the burning human remnants and started running in serpentine, looking for cover. I dove into a doorway and pressed myself flat against the wall, firing across the street. Another ninja went down in flames. Plasma charges were whumping into building walls, and panicked people were running out into the street, right into the line of fire. One woman was stark naked. She took 5 or 6 steps before a stray blast hit her, and a flaming hulk fell to the cratered street. The soldiers had no idea what was happening. They were merely reacting as they had been trained to do. They had been sent in to capture an alien creature, and now suddenly they were facing heavy opposition from an unknown enemy. So they did the only thing they could do, which was to turn their attention to the unknown attacking force. The ninjas couldn't have known what it was all about. Breck had been right. Someone had been watching for us at game headquarters, and we had been tailed expertly by warriors of the Silent Way. They had chosen their time to strike, and, without warning, their lone target had suddenly been joined by several platoons of SS commandos. And the innocent paupers who lived down here in squalor and quiet misery now had a war in the street outside their homes. I didn't know how long it had lasted, but it must have been over fairly quickly. It hadn't seemed quick, though, as I huddled in the doorway, staring wildly out into the street, trying to separate the fleeing bodies of civilians from any black-clad assassins running toward me. The plasma fire died away and left only the screaming of the people in the burning buildings. It was over. The ninjas were all dead, as well as a good number of the soldiers. There was no sign of the alien. I forced my mind to block out the image of the burning jungle and mercenaries moving ponderously in heavy combat armor. I now only saw the flames, the blackened stone of ancient buildings, and the ruptured street littered with burning bodies. Breck! I ran back toward the building where the girl had lived. I racked my brain for the apartment number the cyberpunk had given us. What was it? 3rd floor? G3! I took the littered stairs 3 at a time, slipped in a pile of garbage on the stairwell, caught myself on the railing, then lunged up the final flight of steps, the breath rasping in my throat. The door to G3 was open. Breck was lying on the floor inside, his head bleeding. He was stirring, groaning softly. I found the girl inside the filthy bedroom. The room was bathed in blood. She had been slaughtered like an animal, her chest torn open, entrails hanging out upon the floor. Written on the wall in blood was the chilling phrase,
"Now it begins."
I doubled over and became violently ill. I felt someone steadying me, and when I straightened up, I saw Breck standing beside me, staring into the bedroom with glazed eyes. Blood was running down the side of his face.
"Mein Gott,"
he said. I turned away from the horror.
"You're hurt,"
said Breck.
"What happened?"
"I had it," I said. "I had it cornered. The soldiers landed, and I thought we had the thing. And then a squad of ninjas came out of nowhere and opened with plasma weapons. The whole damn neighborhood's on fire. Everywhere. People. Dead. Sakara. That son of a bitch, Sakara!"
"Course,"
said Breck.
"Cause!"
There was no response. Coles had lost the alien, and he was probably beside himself. He had no time for us. I started crying. I clung to Breck and wept like a baby. He held me in his arms. I felt his blood dripping down onto my face. Breck took a deep breath and let it out slowly.
Come on, he said. Let's get out of here. You and I have a score to settle on the Ginza Strip.
End of chapter.